And when Brenda comes home, she notices that the side garage door is open and the alarm light that they have is flashing.
And it's about 1:45, and the dog, who can't bark, is nonetheless attracting the attention of Danielle's father.
And in order to get to the Van Damme's house from the main road, you have to take 7 to 9 turns to find this house.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, writer, producer, CBS's Criminal Minds, and executive producer of the new America's Most Wanted on Fox. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor and senior producer on the new America's Most Wanted on Fox. Jim, I'm really excited today. We have a brand new guest, someone our listeners and our Patreon subscribers have never seen or heard before on this podcast. Jen, please introduce yourself to our listeners.
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited to be here. My name is Jennifer Shen, and I am a forensic scientist. I've been involved in forensics for almost 30 years. I've worked...
How is that possible?
She's way too young for 30 years.
You're like 22, aren't you?
Yeah, right. Maybe 28.
I started very, very young. Uh-huh. I worked for 3 different agencies. I worked for the San Diego Police Department for almost 25 years. And I started as an analyst, and I worked myself all the way up to lab director. And I was lab director for about 9 years. So I've had a very full career and have been able to work in all sorts of different sections. So I've been at crime scenes. I've done trace evidence and chemistry. And I just have all sorts of
Jennifer,
things.
You just mentioned the magic word chemistry. I was a chemistry major in college, and yeah, I love chemistry.
Jim, you also have some forensics background. I mean, you trained as a CSI the FBI, right?
Yes, but we called them ERTs instead of CSIs.
Because no, CSI is so much sexier, let's be honest.
I know, but, you know, evidence response team is how the FBI decided to call it. And it's a little weird, but whatever. But yes, I did that for 8.5 years in the Bureau. And before I became a profiler and then kind of stayed with behavior for the rest of my career. But we're really excited to hear about a case that you have to talk to us about. So the first thing we always ask is, where in your career were you when this case became yours?
Well, it was a long time ago, and it was actually a very difficult time in my life. I was married with a 3-year-old. I had a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old, essentially.
Wow.
And I was going through a divorce. And it was a very, very difficult time. And the biggest case of my life landed on my lap.
And then when this case came to you, what were you doing on that particular day at that moment when this case landed in your lap?
Well, so I was an analyst at that time. I worked in the trace evidence section. And the trace evidence section, for those of you who are not forensic geeks like me, is a place where everything that isn't a body fluid or a gun or a drug, it goes there. So it can be hairs, fibers, shoe prints, explosives, physical matches, tire tracks, shoe prints, all of that stuff, everything else, right? So it's a really exciting place. Really exciting place to work. I think it's where all the true forensics is done, honestly. But at the moment when this case broke, I was actually at home with the flu.
Well, you told us, you know, sort of your career track. I'm also interested just really quickly in what your background before that was. I mean, we've had people on who were scientists who you know, you said you were interested in chemistry. Was this always your career goal to be in forensics?
Great question. I grew up watching, you'll appreciate this, I grew up watching Perry Mason and,
oh my God, me too.
And Murder, She Wrote. I loved murder mysteries. I love them. And I love Raymond Burr. I had a huge crush on him.
Who doesn't?
I know, right?
I wanted to be so much.
I loved, are you kidding me? Perry Mason was so handsome.
And Paul Drake. Paul Drake was also very handsome. Yeah.
Dreamy. Yeah. Dreamy.
Anyway, I always wanted to be a lawyer. So so at first I wanted to be a lawyer, and then I decided, because I got a job at SeaWorld, that I wanted to be a marine biologist.
So exciting.
Yeah. I got into UCSD, and back in the day, I mean, I sent in one college application to one place and got in. So
yeah.
Now, right? So I got into UCSD and I started down the track of being, studying to be a marine biologist, when at some point, it occurred to me that I was going to have to be out on boats collecting data. Well, I am so motion sick. It is not funny.
I'm right there with you.
Right. So I'm like, what am I doing? So then I'm like, all right, I'm going to be a lawyer and I'm going to go into patent law because I've already gotten I'm working on my biology degree.
What I did while I was in law school. I went to law school at night. I was in a patent firm.
Geeky people. This is a geeky podcast. This is awesome.
How boring, though. I was like, so boring. Who wants to be a patent lawyer? Yuck.
Right.
I got out of college with my biology degree, and I went and worked at a paralegal firm to get some experience in the law. And I realized that I was terrible at it. I was terrible. I couldn't file. I couldn't collate. I could barely staple. I mean, it was awful. I didn't have a job like 3 months after that. I mean, we kind of parted ways because I was miserable and they were miserable. So we parted ways. And, I needed my car smogged. And I was talking to my mom and like, I need you to smog my car for me. And she's like, oh, no, my friend, you get your ass another job. Okay.
Smog your car for me. Now, that's got to be a California statement, right?
I have no idea what she's talking about. I didn't want to appear ignorant by asking.
Francie, it's not
too hard, is it?
Yeah. Okay. No, but... that means get your car tested or adjusted or repaired so it passes the smog test.
Oh, we call it emissions testing here.
Yes. Well, we in California like to use short, cool words. So whatever.
Of course.
Smog test. Anyway, I whipped out the want ads and I started just looking and I found a job at a toxicology company that did, the majority of it did pre-employment drug testing. But there was this little tiny group within that company that had a contract with the San Diego Police Department to do all their blood and urine drug testing for the people they had arrested for being under the influence. So I applied. It was for literally, I mean, here I have a UCSD biology degree, and it was for someone to literally label urine bottles, wash them, you know, keep track of the supply.
Seriously sexy stuff, in other words.
Right, right. Yeah. And anytime you say urine in a sentence, it's super sexy. So I interviewed. I thought I did extraordinarily well, honestly. 2 weeks later, I had heard nothing and I still didn't have a job and my car was not smogged. So I actually called them up and said, hey, you know, have you filled that position yet? And he said, no, we haven't. And I said, oh, well, are you interested in me? And he said, no, we're not. Not because, you know, you are honestly overqualified for this job. And I'm like, you know what? I need a job really bad. How about if I promise that I will work for you for 2 years, no matter what, I'll work for you for 2 years. And he said, okay, I will hire you.
There you go. Look at that.
Good job, Jennifer.
So, yeah. Thanks very much. I was desperate, honestly. So
now I can say that he said to you, you're in.
You're in.
No.
Oh, yeah. That was great. I'm going to use that. So,
okay.
Honestly, at that point, I started off as the person who was, you know, labeling urine bottles, all that kind of stuff. I did that for 3 months.
You heard you say promoted. Urine.
I did hear, Jim.
Okay.
What are you, 12 all of a sudden?
Did you know that back in the day, the way that you did your first analysis of a urine sample for drugs is that you took some of the urine and you
put
it test tube and you heat it up so it's hot. 3 months later, I was promoted to a chemist, and 3 months after that, my boss left. So being the only one with the degree necessary, I actually was promoted to the head of that section.
Wow.
And right.
In so, 6 months.
6 months.
You so took I, over.
Woo-woo. So I was actually doing the testimony, helping with method development. I had three people working for me at the tender age of 21 or whatever it was.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And, that was last year.
Yeah. Ish. Right.
So I went back to school. I really liked the testimony.
Was your mom proud? Was your mom proud?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do.
She made your career. Come on. She told you to get a job. You got this job, right?
Yeah. You know, I have really awesome parents. So bottom line is I loved it. I loved the fact that you could take science and then you could talk about it all the time to people. I'm a talker, in case you have not noticed yet. I just loved it. So I went back to school to get my master's degree in forensic science at night. I worked for 2 years and 1 month, and then I was hired at the sheriff's department as a criminalist, where I did drug analysis and I ran their toxicology section for them. I worked for the sheriff's department for about 2.5 years, and then I was hired at the San Diego Police Department, where I entered the trace evidence section. And so I spent 10 years doing that, just loved it, and doing crime scene reconstruction at that time. So I just got so much experience, and I was in the trace evidence section when this case fell on my lap.
So, Jennifer, how hard did this fall on your lap? What happened when you got this case?
Well, it fell on my lap pretty hard, but as I said, I was at home sick with the flu. So all of this went down and everybody had to respond but me. So I was watching it on television, and it was quite exciting. So this case occurred in February of 2002, and February 1st, 2002, the Van Dams sort of embarked on this very horrific, time of their life as their daughter went missing. So February 1st, Brenda Van Dam, who is Danielle Van Dam's mother, met her friends and they went out to a local bar called Dad's in Poway. They went out, they had fun, they had a good time. Damon Van Dam, Danielle's father, stayed at home with Danielle and her two brothers. So they were at home, they did their thing. He put them to bed about 10:30. He went to bed about 11 o'clock.
And how old are all these three kids, just approximately?
Danielle was seven and her brothers were a little older. So very young. So the dad was home with the kids and the dog, went to bed. Everything's good. At about 1:45 in the morning, Damon realizes that the dog is making a lot of noise and kind of carrying on. He doesn't really understand what that's about, but the dog is definitely upset. About 1:45 in the morning.
But I should add one thing to this, and I have to admit to everybody that this case also fell on my lap on that same day or night. But I was on the East Coast. But that the dog was sort of a designer dog, and he had his larynx removed so that he couldn't bark.
Correct.
So the dog was making a fuss, but not barking at anything because he was fixed that way.
Yeah, one of the many real tragedies, I think, in the whole setup of this crime was that fact. And it was interesting.
You're telling us about the crime, and it's about 1:45, and the dog, who can't bark, is nonetheless attracting the attention of Danielle's father.
Correct. So at about 2:30 in the morning, Brenda and her friends come home. And when Brenda comes home, she notices that the side garage door is open and the alarm light that they have is flashing. So they note that's odd. They all come in, they talk, they have pizza. And about 2:30, everybody goes to bed and all the neighbors leave. All her friends leave. So then at about 3:30 in the morning, the dog makes another fuss and Damon wakes up and realizes that the alarm light is flashing again. So he goes downstairs and looks around, and that's when he notices the back sliding glass door is open. So in another tragedy of this case, he looks around, he goes into the garage to make sure no one has stolen any of his bikes, etc. But here he does not go and check on the children. And when Brenda came home with her friends, they did not check on the children. Nobody checked on the children that night. Everybody, of course, was assuming they're in their beds asleep, done everything perfectly correctly, but no one ever checked to see if the kids were in their rooms and okay. So that is kind of how that night went.
Yeah.
The next morning at 9:15, one of the neighbor kids comes over and she wants to play with Danielle. So Brenda goes up to Danielle's room to wake her up, to have her come play with her friend, and she's not there. She's gone. And, you know, as at that moment in time, I had very young children. And this is just a case that just stabbed me to my core from the very beginning. It was very personal, right? It was very personal. Right. Because here you had a father home with the kids. They didn't leave the kids home alone. They weren't doing anything crazy. They were home with their kids, put them to bed. There's a dog there. And yet she was missing.
This case was so publicly put out in the press when all this was happening at the same time you were learning of it. I think, Jen, I have a very vivid memory of seeing photographs online of the sliding door. I mean, when you said it, it triggered my memory of, I know I've seen that because it was so, you know, there was so much going on. So, all right. So 9:30 or 9:15, they discover that Danielle, who's 7, is missing. What next?
Correct. So this frantic search ensues. They search the house. They search the house. They go outside. They drive around. They do all this stuff. They're looking everywhere for her. And at 9:40, they call the police and they just say, you know, my daughter's missing. And I've heard, I'm sure, Jim, you've heard this 911 call. It's horrifying to listen to a mom be so distressed that her child is missing. So she calls 911 and officers arrive. And very shortly after they get there, they realize this is not just some normal, the kid walked out or the kid, you know, ran away or something. They realize right away that this is going to be a big deal. And so they bring in their robbery detectives who also specialize in kidnapping. And they sort of descend on the neighborhood and this massive search starts. So over the next several days, people are searching everywhere. I mean, they are searching Chula Vista, El Cajon comes out, they have the mounted police, they have American Sand Association searching in the deserts, all the way to Riverside, Imperial County, everybody's searching everywhere. Because they know they have to have this Herculean effort to have any chance of finding her.
Right. Well, they actually were following our child abduction response plan to the T. And part of that was activating the FBI's child abduction rapid deployment team. And myself and another and Tom Neer got on a plane and flew out there. We didn't get there, obviously, till, you know, late in that day.
Well, and Jim, I know that you've talked about this a lot, but so I want to ask first Jen and then Jim, but Jen, what kind of neighborhood was this? Can you just sort of describe the, I mean, is it, you know, a fairly large neighborhood of homes? Does it back up to a lake or woods, or kind of give us the overall outlook of it?
Yeah, this neighborhood is in Poway. It was sort of, it's upper middle class, very, very nice neighborhood, lots of houses. You know, it just was one of those neighborhoods that you would grow up on and all your friends are all around you, cul-de-sac, you know, just a very, you know, you always hear this every single time. Like, I can't imagine something like this happened in my neighborhood, or I can't imagine it was someone who lived next door. It was one of those places where you're just like, you know, it's so hard to imagine that anything like this could happen here.
And Jim, Francie, you talked about that sort of neighborhood thing. Can you describe that for people who might not have heard?
Absolutely. So here, we immediately got the map out. And I remember vividly, and this is a very good question, Francie, because it was one of the pivotal things that we saw right away. There are several hundred homes in this community, in this neighborhood. And in order to get to the Van Damme's house from the main road, you have to take 7 to 9 turns. You can't just go out off the main road, make a left, and you're there. You have to take 7 to 9 turns to find this house. And we thought immediately, it's got to be somebody who was incredibly intimately familiar with this house, in order to, or this neighborhood, in order to have pulled this off, to get in there, find her vulnerable, and get out of there. It had to be something, you know, somebody who was very familiar, who lived, worked, or played in that neighborhood.
Okay. Well, so Jen, so then you're at home with the flu, the case comes in, you guys are hearing all these details. What happens after police are called, neighborhoods are being searched, mounted police, desert police, all this was going on. What happens next?
So the next thing that happens is that Van Dam home becomes a crime scene. It is a crime scene. And so now the forensic personnel are going to descend on that, and they're going to look for any kind of clues that they could find, anything that could give them a hint as to what happened to her. And so while they're doing that, so while the forensic scientists are there and doing that, then we have our, you know, our detectives canvassing the neighborhood, interviewing people. They gave, as is very normal, I'm sure, Jim, you could speak to this, they immediately polygraphed the parents so that we could sort of put them aside as suspects.
Yeah, sure. You want to rule them out right away. They were very cooperative, and they passed the polygraph with flying colors. I will say that there was some shenanigans going on that raised some issues, because the family, basically, they were kind of swingers. And, you know, so some of those friends that came over were kind of, everybody was all fooling around and stuff. So that kind of raised some eyebrows a little bit in law enforcement. Like, did this raise the risk level to the children to a very high level? So we looked into all that and basically cleared it, you know, said, no, this had nothing to do with the parents and or their friends. So it was an issue, though, that we had to explore, because, you know, when you are dealing with a child abduction, especially of a child of tender years, that the family, you know, has typically such a tight ring of care and control and custody over a child that young, that they are actually the highest risk to be offenders in that kind of case. So you have to clear the family first. You have to make sure that they're not involved first. And then you can go, you know, at the same time, you're obviously doing a neighborhood canvas and you're expanding out in these concentric rings from the last known sighting, which was when she was put to bed the night before.
So Jen, so yeah, you say that their parents are polygraphed, they're set aside as suspects fairly quickly, as Jim says, ruled out. What happens next? What are you guys looking for in the house? I mean, if the parents are ruled out as suspects very early on, that means there's going to be a lot of potential evidence at the house, right?
Right. And so that's what they're looking for there. They're looking for a variety of things, but you would be trying to figure out if you could see where someone came in or went out. And in those areas, for instance, the sliding door or the garage door or in her room, wherever, you might be looking for fingerprints or hairs or someone dropped something that might identify. I had a case one time where the bad guy literally dropped his library card at the crime scene, you know, so that was super helpful. You know, you're looking for anything that might give you a clue as to who did this, or did she leave on her own? And is there anything that would indicate that for some reason a seven-year-old would want to leave the home? So that's what they're doing. But right now it's very investigative thrust. So they're looking at the parents, and then they interviewed all of the people that they were with. And to Jim's point, it was a very difficult time for those parents in a lot of ways. And one is their lifestyle was definitely thrown out there into the media. There was just so much judgment on these people who are going through what has to be, hopefully for them, the absolute worst tragedy of their entire lives, almost unimaginable pain. And then they also were having their character assassinated. So we do have to look at those things, but it was really tough. It made it even worse. So one of the things that they noticed right away was that all the neighbors were present except for one.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
All the neighbors were present, except for one. One was gone.
What do you mean present? Present how?
They knocked on everybody's door during the neighborhood canvas, and everybody was home, except for one of the neighbors.
Correct. And one of our detectives, Mo Parga, she was at that neighbor's house, and she was looking at it. And she thought, you know, this person who lives there is very neat, very tidy. Everything is exactly in its place as it should be, except there is a garden hose that stretched all the way across the lawn and had just been left there. And she felt like that was odd. It looked to her like that person might have left in a hurry. And so that piqued her interest specifically. So after, you know, as the weekend progressed and they had talked to everyone, David Westerfield, the neighbor that was missing, arrived home, and he arrived home on Monday morning. And that was a big pivotal moment for this case.
Absolutely.
Ooh, okay.
I remember seeing the news reports. By this time, we should say that almost every news agency in the world was there. Danielle, was a cute, beautiful little young girl, and it's the kind of case that the media really is attracted to. And as you know, Jennifer, because you've worked in this field for a long time, well, since you were 22, for a year at this point, no, but that unfortunately, certain cases draw the media attention and certain cases do not. And of course, we address all of them equally. It's just that the media and the worldwide media does not come running for little girls or little boys who do not look like Danielle. And it's just a shame because we could use that same kind of attention in every case, but we don't get it.
No, but just a point, Jim, you and I do. We have covered,
right,
and we have tweeted and we have publicized every, you know, missing kind of child case.
Yeah, that's what
that
I said.
We see come across our desks.
Right. We do that. And we certainly did it professionally. And Jennifer and the Sheriff's Department and the Police Department in San Diego, they all do it. But the media does not cover them the same. And
agreed.
In this particular case, though, I remember vividly watching a newscaster walk up to Mr. Westerfield, and I'll let you take it over because Jennifer, I'm sure you saw the same thing I saw.
I did. One further thought on that. I always found that the crimes that get the most coverage also are the ones where people can imagine themselves in them. And one of the things about this case that was so traumatizing is that everybody could say, oh, I was home with my kids all night long. I forgot to check on my daughter before I went to bed. You know, could this happen to me? And I think when you can really put yourself in the place of the victims, it's so much more traumatizing and you can identify. So some of that was going on here as well, I think. Anyway, when David Westerfield got home and he was talked to by the police, he said, you know, he'd been out in his motorhome all weekend long, traveling in the desert, camping, something he did on a regular basis. He was known as sort of Desert Dave to his friends. He took his son and his friends out to the desert on a regular basis. So it would be normal that he would be gone for the weekend doing this sort of thing. He had no criminal history, so there was really nothing to suspect on its face. However,
so far, let me just summarize. So far, on the neighbor, the things you have that could direct suspicion at him are he just happened to not be there mm-hmm. when everyone woke up in the morning and Danielle was found to be missing, and two, a garden hose seemed out of place. A detective noticed, which I just think is what's so miraculous to me about detectives and investigators, that they are trained to notice things like that, that most of us would just be like, well, not even notice.
Yeah. Well, you know, and so the other thing that was of interest about this particular neighbor is that when they did their in-depth interviews, the police did their in-depth interviews with Brenda and Damon and the gals that she was at the bar with, David Westerfield's name did come up. So he came up several times. So he was also at the bar when they were at the bar. So he was there. And Brenda had taken her daughter, Danielle, and one of her sons to his house the week before to sell Girl Scouts cookies. So she was actually in his home selling Girl Scout cookies with her daughter and son. So his name, so we got the garden hose. He wasn't there. And then you have... the fact that his name kept popping up. But the other thing that was very interesting is when they talked to him, he seemed off. He was very cooperative, very friendly, over the top, sweating profusely. They thought, something's not right here. And to Jim's point, he did a news interview, which was really shocking. Mm-hmm. It was very shocking. And you know, I just watched it at the time. I was like, what is wrong with that guy? I mean, you have one of your neighbors going through this horrific, horrific experience. You've been gone. You've arrived home to this tragedy. And you're like, oh, how do I look at my hat? You know, it's
right. Okay, so he basically said, like, they had him out in front of the house and they had the camera set up. And he said, wait a minute. And he goes inside and he gets a baseball cap. And he said, this looks much better, doesn't it? You know, like, he was all concerned about his looks. And then, you know, it's all about him. Everything is about him. And that behavior really struck us when, you know, that's what we're focused on. Obviously, we rely tremendously on forensics. But when forensics doesn't tell the complete picture, we look at the behavior. And his behavior, like you said, seemed very off.
Well, doesn't that remind you, Jim, a little bit of a more recent case, the tragic case of Shannon Watts and her children that were killed by Chris Watts. And one of the things that was, I think, a turning point in that investigation was his interview with the media, where his behavior seemed completely inconsistent with someone who should be a grieving father. Now, I understand a grieving father, a purportedly grieving father, is very different than a neighbor. But still, if you've had a child in your house selling you cookies and you've been neighbors for a long time and you're at a bar and so you know the parents at least casually, it seems to me completely and wholly inappropriate to act as though it's all about you and to not even appear, which it sounds like you guys are telling me, a little bit sad or concerned for the child.
Right.
You know, there was quite a bit of smiling, but one of the things that happened in that interview, I don't know if you remember this, Jim, but he did say that he thought that Damon was out of town. He had overheard something happening and he thought Damon was out of town. So it did make the investigators wonder, did he think that there was a babysitter there with the kids? So that I thought was very interesting. And that
yeah, and what, you know, what it boiled down to was the week before, the mom and her friends were out at dad's bar and Westfield came up to them, bought them drinks. They accepted the drinks. And then he kind of tried to worm his way into the group and they were like creeped out by him and they kind of shunned him. And then I think within a day or two, Mrs. Van Dam is bringing Danielle and her brother around selling Girl Scout cookies. They get to Westfield's house last. He said, oh yeah, come on in. I'll buy cookies. And he buys some cookies. And he says to her, you know, are you going to be out at dad's again this this weekend? And she said, no, my husband's taking the boys on a ski trip, I think it was. And so I'll be home alone with Danielle. Mm. Okay, that's sort of the setup. He also made a mention of their lifestyle and how he hosts adult parties at his house and maybe they should all get together. And she was like, okay, gotta go. And he asked for her number. She gave him her husband's number, something like that, because she was creeped out by the guy. So all that is sort of the precursor. And it set up a situation where, the mother actually shows up at dad's bar that night anyway, that Saturday anyway. So what does he think?
Yeah. So Jennifer, so there you are, you know, you guys are investigating the house. You're trying to get any forensic information or forensic evidence that might exist that would show someone's in the house, Danielle left the house, any of those things. So y'all are, you know, you see this media interview. What happens next?
So on Monday, February 4th, so this is a few days after she's reported missing, Westerfield agrees to have a polygraph. So the polygraph section also in the laboratory, also something that I oversaw as my time as the director there. I don't think you should ever take a polygraph if you've done something bad.
Note to self.
Ever. Not,
ever, never, never. You shouldn't even take a polygraph if you haven't done something bad. They are very not fun and terrible. But he agreed to take a polygraph. And when he was asked, did you have anything to do with the disappearance of Danielle Van Damme? He responded. His body chemistry responded. And for those of you that don't know, basically, when you lie, if you're not a psychopath, your body responds. Your blood pressure goes up. Your breathing increases. Your temperature rises. And so there's all these little things that are plugged into you as you do the test that measure that. So they ask.
And he had a problem with sweating too.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. So perspiration increases as well.
Right. So it's just that you're just measuring your body's response to lying because you know you're lying. And so therefore, something that was discovered long, long time ago by the guy who invented Wonder Woman, by the way, invented the polygraph. So that was
interesting. I had no idea.
Right. That's kind of exciting. So once that happened, now they've got all of these things we talked about and they have a polygraph where he clearly has something to do with it. And the polygrapher and the detectives at the time thought, hey, you know what? This guy knows something. So by the 5th, they put him under 24-hour surveillance, which is very important.
Well, in the meantime, is there any forensic evidence that your team finds? Is there anything with respect to fingerprints or, I don't know, blood, anything that suggests what went on or how Danielle got out of the house that's going on while all this is happening with Westerfield?
So we are madly looking at the house, but we can't look at anything else until we get a search warrant. And the search warrant comes after an in-depth interview with Westerfield, where he talks about where he was over the weekend. And it is a crazy, crazy story where he gets up at 6:30 in the morning on Saturday and he leaves his house at 7:45 in his SUV. And then he drives to where his motorhome is located, picks it up, leaves the SUV there, drives back to his house, fills it all up with stuff. Then he drives all the way down to the beach. Then he drives past his house out to the desert where he does this crazy 500-mile trip where he gets stuck several times. He comes back late Sunday night. He drives back past his home down to the beach and then back to Sky Ridge at like 4:30 a.m. on Monday morning. Picks up his SUV, falls asleep, and then winds up back at the house in his motorhome at like 8:30 Monday morning, which is when the detectives made contact with him. So he talks about this ridiculous trip for an experienced camper, an experienced desert Dave, that he just did all these ridiculous things, including getting stuck in the sand.
It doesn't sound relaxing or vacation-y at all.
No, and you're right. And he got stuck in the sand, which, you know, he's driven out there. He's known as desert. He knows that he can't drive that thing into the soft desert and all that, but he did it anyway. And another thing that stuck out was that he went to a gas station and he made a big show of asking a kid, hey, can you go inside and buy me a newspaper, today's newspaper? And he pays this kid to go inside and get him a newspaper And then he brings out the newspaper. And then, you know, I mean, it was like this whole, like, what, you're filling a tank that probably has 100 gallons of gas in it, right? Because you're driving all over the place. Why don't you spend that time walking in, get it? He paid a kid to do it. And that was a really weird thing. But what it did was it gave him a newspaper and a receipt from that place at that time. Looked like maybe he was creating his own alibi.
Yes, I agree. So to answer your question, Francie, we now had this ridiculous alibi, the garden hose, his behavior, the polygraph, and that was enough to get a search warrant, which is what we needed. So we were able to get a search warrant for the his home, his motorhome, and his SUV. And that is when all the forensics started.
Ooh, okay. Love it.
All one right, additional thing that we added to that search warrant was his computers, because we said if he is the actual perpetrator in this crime, that there would be some indication somewhere of an interest, a sexual interest in children. So we also wanted to look at his computers to see.
All right. So is it still, what day is it? Tuesday, Wednesday, something like that?
Yes. We're a few days into the next week and we get the search warrant. So the first thing we do is we take a look at his home. And, you know, Jim's absolutely correct. It's even more true now than it was then, but we go for the phones now, not so much back then, but the computers, phones, because you're trying to look at if there's any digital evidence that, and now you can say, where did someone travel? What were they searching? Who were they talking to? Text, emails, Snapchats, whatever. So we did take a look at his computer. And one of the first things we found is that there was a lot of pornography on his computer. And there was child pornography on his computer. And there were rape scenes on his computer. Some of those were child rapes and some of them are very violent. So right away, you're like, we have a person who might have some proclivities that might make it more likely that he would be involved in this kind of case.
And just a little, we saw a tremendous amount of pornography, as Jennifer said, but it was all labeled and categorized and, you know, very, very
organized,
broad spectrum of pornography. And so right away from a behavioral spectrum, we thought this is a diverse sexual offender, somebody who's sexually diverse, who has multiple sexual attractions, somebody who is capable of having a sexual attraction to adults and children, animals and other things. I mean, just it was all over the place, all the fetish stuff. And so, but it was all just like his, like the neighbor described him, very meticulous, very organized, very everything in its place. And which, you know, then again, fed into this whole thing about him being a sexually diverse potential offender here.
Yeah, I had some child pornography cases at the Department of Justice where the offenders were that meticulous about categorizing the material, the child abuse material by, you know, age, sometimes hair color, gender, all sorts of different things. And I always felt like those people tended to have, and it was, by the way, it was for me anyway, it was men, but those men tended to have the largest collections, just hundreds of thousands of images, lots of video images. And they also seem to have the most abusive material like you've described, Jennifer. And those were the people that I fought the hardest to keep in prison for as long as possible because they represented to me the highest danger to children because of what I felt like was a clear sexual attraction to children and not just, you know, some interest in images, which is always what defense attorneys say and always has driven me insane because we know that that's not the case. But so Jennifer, so you guys, you have his computers, you see this collection of some violent child pornography. What happens next?
So then we're going to look for evidence. We're going to look for forensic evidence because so far we don't actually have anything that ties him to her.
No fingerprints of him or anybody in her house, nothing forensically on the scene of where she was abducted.
Right. So the first thing we take after that, we look at the computer, is we take the bedding from the master bedroom, and they take the laundry. There is laundry in the washer and the dryer and on top of the dryer. So they take all of the laundry.
Can I just ask, I'm sorry, Jen, to interrupt you. Can I just ask one quick question?
Yeah.
You guys obviously at this point suspect him. He's clearly the prime suspect. And so you have to be, well, just could you describe for me what you and your team are feeling as far as urgency? I mean, you have to be operating in almost like a panic mode because you're hoping you can rescue the child. So can you describe the pressures of that sort of feeling, you know, with the pressure of doing everything by the book, which can sometimes be a longer process than you might like?
You know, that's a really great question. And, you know, from my perspective, I've always felt a little insulated from the investigative aspect. I mean, I know the detectives, the command staff, you know, all the people that were helping us were just frantically trying to find her. So we as scientists and, you know, as specialists have to be very, very systematic. And it's tough. It's tough on our investigators sometimes. And like, you know, I have to do this right. We have to do it right. Because if you rush, you could miss something. I mean, I've had scenes where there was blood everywhere, but there was one little stain in one little spot that didn't seem like it belonged. And if I wasn't paying absolute attention, I wouldn't have noticed it. And that is the one that belongs to the suspect. You have to do it right. And so we always try to tell ourselves, you know, we need to take the time. I mean, there's definitely urgency. And, you know, as parents and sisters and brothers and, you know, uncles, nieces, whatever, we get it. I mean, these kind of cases are just traumatizing. So everyone's working. They work all the way through that. They work as long as they need to in a row, hours and hours and hours through the night into the next day, whatever they need to do to get it done. But we do it systematically because we know we have to, because we cannot mess it up. So that's kind of where we are on that. But the other thing that was done in this case, which I've not ever seen done before, it was brilliant, I thought, was we took the lint out of the dryer trap. And we took a lint. There was a ball of lint in the garage in a trash can. So just to remind you what we're doing here is we're trying to show that Danielle Van Dam, who doesn't live with him, shouldn't have been in his environment, shouldn't have any of her in his world, was present. So all of the things we're doing in forensics is we're just trying to show that two people who should not have had contact with each other did come in contact. A person
you're trying to put that there is evidence of that child in his house where she would only have been if a crime was committed.
Correct. And so since there wasn't anything obvious like her backpack or her clothing, we're looking for trace evidence, microscopic, tiny, small particles that we can show if there's enough of them. The only way they all could have gotten there is if she had been in this house. So that's what we're doing. So that's why all the laundry, all the bedding, the lint, we're going to look at all that stuff microscopically to see what we can find. And is any of what we find come from Danielle? So that's right. The point of what we're doing.
One of the things one of the suggestions that we came up with from the behavioral analysis unit when we looked at that was having them collect that lint. Because what one of the officers said is when they went in, they smelled bleach, they smelled cleaning products, like he had spent a tremendous amount of time cleaning up. And I think they found two or three empty bleach containers, you know, the gallon jugs empty in the house. That seemed like they were, that he was actually attempting to clean up. So one of the things that struck me was that if he didn't leave anything there at the house, maybe she brought something with her. If she had a dog and the dog sheds, that hair is going to be on her and it's going to come with her wherever she goes. So that's one of the reasons why we suggested that they collect the lint from the dryer, because they said all this stuff was piled up, like he had done the bedding for the master bedroom and it was all piled up on top of the dryer. So it had already been washed and dried and it was stacked on top, unfolded, I believe. So, man, when we come back next week, we were on a really dive into all the forensics and find out what you found as a result of this search. Because really, the fact that there was nothing at all left at the Van Damme's house by the offender told us that that person who committed this crime was very forensically sophisticated. And when we start looking into the background of Mr. Westerfield, we were really shocked to find out one of the things that he had done professionally in his life. And we'll tell you all about it next week when Jennifer Shen comes back and tells us the conclusion of this fascinating story.
Yeah, thanks, Jen. I mean, it drives our listeners crazy when we break our stories apart, but you will come back and tell us the rest, right?
Yes, I will.
Excellent.
I'd be happy to.
Awesome. Well, you are an amazing storyteller. I wish Francie was more like you. And that we are so happy to have you. And the world is so grateful for the work that you did and do. It's very difficult. Very difficult, I'm sure, especially because you were a mother of young children at the time. And, you know, this case, I know it tore me up and Tom and everybody in our unit, because we were so, so concerned about Danielle.
Yeah, it's the one that has moved me most in my career, for sure.
Yeah. Well, everybody, thank you for listening and watching. And we will be back with Jennifer Shen to tell us the continuation of this horrific but important case. So till next time, thank you for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production, produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gerbel. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.